Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices overlooking San Francisco's historic Market Street. I'm Gloria Duffy, CEO of the Commonwealth Club and your chair for today. We also welcome the listeners of KSYL-AM and KQID-FM in Alexandria, Louisiana, two of more than 225 radio stations carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners here and on radio to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's speaker. It is a great pleasure to introduce to you today the Foreign Minister of Egypt, Mr. Amre Moussa. He was appointed in 1991 as the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Egypt after having served as a career diplomat for over 32 years. With a license degree in law from Cairo University in 1957, he began his diplomatic career in 1958. He's been involved primarily through his diplomatic career in the area of multilateral diplomacy, in charge of international organizations for the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, and of Egypt's policies within the UN system and other different international and regional organizations. He served at the UN mission of Egypt in New York from 1969 to 1974. And as you may recall, this was a particularly crucial period in the United Nations because many of the major UN resolutions and initiatives for the Palestinian cause in the Arab-Israeli conflict were addressed during that period. Security Council Resolution 338 was adopted to form with the famous Resolution 242 the legal basis of the peace process in the Middle East. Foreign Minister Moussa served as the Director of International Organization Department in the Egyptian Foreign Ministry between 1977 and 1981, moving again to New York to become the alternate permanent representative of Egypt to the UN until 1983. Then he became Egypt's ambassador to India. Then he returned to Cairo in 1986 to resume his functions as the Director of the International Organization Department. During all these years which preceded his going back to New York as Egypt's ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations in 1990, he was a standing member of various Egyptian teams for negotiations with Israel after the 1973 war and in the historic initiative of President Sadat that started the new era in the Middle East, leading the region in its quest for a comprehensive and final peace. In 1991, he was called by President Mubarak to become Egypt's foreign minister and to lead Egyptian diplomacy in the efforts to find a final and complete settlement of political differences and security issues in the Middle East. He was involved in the convening of the Madrid Conference for the Middle East other bilateral and multilateral negotiations on the Middle East from 1991 to 1996. And in most recent years as Egyptian foreign minister, he has devoted a significant amount of his time and energy to the development of the economy of Egypt in the region and internationally, economic reforms in Egypt, and in general, Egypt's integration into the world economy. On a personal note, Minister Moussa is married to Dr. Leila Badawi, an engineer and professor of computer sciences at Cairo University. They have a daughter, Hania, who graduated from AUC with a degree in business administration, and a son, Hazem, who graduated this year in the United States with a degree in economics. Please join us in a warm welcome to Foreign Minister Amre Moussa of Egypt. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Duffy, for your very kind introduction, detailed introduction indeed. And thank you for inviting me to join you today and have the pleasure to address this fine gathering on issues of common concern for the U.S. and Egypt. Dr. Duffy, distinguished officers of the board, Mr. Chairman. It is indeed a privilege and source of great pleasure to address the members of this prominent club, the oldest and largest public affairs forum in the nation. It is an inspiration to follow in the footsteps of scores of world leaders who have spoken here and who have shaped the world history in the last century. A few days ago, I was reading an article about U.S. policy, and I was surprised to note that the U.S. has become the number one exporter of revolutions around the world. The Internet revolution, digital revolution, genetic revolution, e-commerce revolution, and the mobile commerce revolution. I must tell you, those are revolutions we warmly welcome and need in the Middle East today. In fact, this afternoon, I will be visiting the Silicon Valley, accompanied by a business delegation, with a view to promoting Egyptian-American cooperation in these new technologies, which are changing man's interaction with his world and environment. President Mubarak will be visiting Washington next week. He will be paying a visit to the major information technology companies in Northern Virginia, Silicon Valley of the East, or East Coast. We expect to add a new and exciting file to Egyptian-American cooperation in the IT field. Ladies and gentlemen, Egypt has ushered in the new millennium with an ambitious national project for a comprehensive technology revival. Its objectives are to develop an information society and to create a strong industry that would promote job creation and export expansion. The new strategy is built on four major pillars. One, technology infrastructure development. Two, human resource development. By preparing qualified, skilled labor and top-notch graduates capable of developing cutting-edge technologies. Three, information base building, which would provide reliable and timely information to support planning and decision-making. And four, the business development, by building a strong industry that can fulfill local demand and compete in a more versatile market. You might be interested in knowing that Egypt ranks second after China in software market expansion. Our demand for software is enormous. Computer giants such as Oracle, Intel, Microsoft, HP, and IBM are heavily recruiting Arabic software programs from Egypt. Steps are being taken to position Egypt as the hub of Arabic software in the region. A very promising market in view of our expanding pool of experts in information technology, some of whom are accompanying me this afternoon, and many of whom occupy leading positions in computer companies in California. In other efforts, we are working closely with our biggest trade partner, that's the U.S., to upgrade our telecommunications, infrastructure, and IT environment. Our goal is clear: to establish a Delta Valley, a small Silicon Valley in Egypt. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, the new millennium marks the emergence of a new Egypt onto the global stage, one that is forging its way as a liberal market-based economy, with the private sector as its main engine of growth. This sector is what is now managing the most strategic aspects of our economy, areas that were once the domain of the public sector, such as power stations, utilities, airports, and telecommunications. Central to this campaign is our Build, Own, Operate Transfer Program, or BOOT. It provides for the phased opening of key industries to private capital and management. Under BOOT, infrastructure projects alone are expected to generate more than $11 billion in new private sector contracts over the next few years. Since its resurgence in 1995, Egypt's stock exchange has witnessed a strong growth record, one that reflects the rise of the private sector and our ambitious privatization program. The privatization of the Egyptian telephone company, due to start in May of this year, the year 2000, will potentially increase market capitalization by around $15 billion. This will be followed by other major privatizations, of which the biggest is privatization of Egypt's electricity authority. To sustain high growth rates in the future, we are working hard to increase investments, develop savings, promote greater economic openness and integration with the world economy, increase exports, instill the concept of modern style corporate governance in Egyptian companies, expand our infrastructure, increase transparency in policy development, and last but definitely not least, support greater development of our human resources. There is a great appetite for change and a unanimous will to reform. The Egyptian citizen is at the heart of our efforts to turn vision into reality. There is still much more to accomplish, and more reforms are on the way. Institution building, raising productivity, encouraging greater competition, and improving education are all goals we are committed to. The road ahead may be long, but I assure you, there are no U-turns in Egypt's economic renewal agenda. Creating a knowledge-based economy is our greatest challenge. It is the price for success in the 21st century. Ladies and gentlemen, being in San Francisco, birthplace of the UN system, whose motto is peace, and home of the Nuclear Weapons Elimination Initiative, strongly advocated by the State of the World Forum, I cannot let this opportunity go without addressing you on our vision of regional security for the Middle East. The first pillar of the regional security is reaching a just, lasting, and comprehensive peace in the Middle East. This entails reaching a just solution on all three tracks of the peace process, or the three remaining tracks on the peace process, that is the Palestinian, Syrian, and Lebanese, on the basis of the principle of land for peace. Egypt and the U.S. are working hand in hand, as they have for the last two decades, to achieve this objective. 2 weeks ago, President Mubarak hosted President Arafat and Prime Minister Barak in Sharm el-Sheikh, a summit which restored the talks between the Palestinians and Israelis after a long lull. The coming few weeks will witness an intensified round of diplomatic activity aimed at reinvigorating the peace process. President Mubarak will meet President Arafat in the next couple of days, then travel to Washington next week. We'll consult with President Clinton on ways to advance peace on all those tracks. President Clinton will also be meeting with President Assad in Geneva next Sunday to discuss ways to resume negotiations on the Syrian track. Today in Washington, Palestinian and Israeli negotiating teams will resume their negotiations on the final status talks, addressing issues, very difficult issues like Jerusalem, refugees, water, and the borders. In all of this, the role of the U.S. is crucial in sustaining the momentum we hope will be achieved through our joint efforts. With an active and energetic American role, we hope that the goal of reaching a just and lasting settlement between Israel and the Palestinians, also with the Syrians and Lebanese, will be realized this year. The triangle of peace has three indispensable sides: total withdrawal, full normalization, and security for all. This applies to all three tracks. Peace requires that all parties perceive a settlement to be just and that the rewards of peace be distributed fairly. Attempting to reach peace upon the requirements of one side shall never succeed, let alone endure. The Arab countries have emphasized in no uncertain terms their commitment to comprehensive, just, and equitable peace as a strategic choice to be achieved through negotiations with Israel. The second fundamental pillar for regional security rests on the adequate resolution of the armaments issue in the Middle East. The vast stockpiles, the rampant arms race, and the danger of proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, in particular nuclear weapons, is a threat to regional peace and stability. We must build a regional security regime based on the principle of equal rights and obligations, which is aimed at achieving military balance and enhancing equal security at the lowest level of armament. A regime that is designed to limit certain conventional weapons, eliminate all weapons of mass destruction and their delivery system, and develop a network of confidence-building measures to avoid misunderstandings and misperceptions. This regime will have to effectively address the deep disequilibrium in legal obligations undertaken by the regional parties in the field of weapons of mass destruction, in particular with regard to the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Peace and security will neither be comprehensive nor durable if regional security is not ensured and the issue of arms control is not resolved. Egypt has called and will continue to call for the establishment of a zone free of all weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East, without exception to any country or to any weapon. This is the only way to advance security for all. Attempts to preserve one party's security at the expense of the others is, to use Middle Eastern slang, the mother of insecurity. It is a recipe for a dangerous arms race. Today, we reach out to all those who advocate the elimination of nuclear weapons to help us achieve this goal. This is not a luxury. This is the only sure way forward. The third pillar of regional stability and security lies in advancing regional economic cooperation. The achievement of comprehensive peace and balanced security will allow this region to finally unleash its great economic potential in terms of demographic composition. This is one of the fastest growing regions in the world. It witnessed 30% growth in the last decade to reach 310 million people and is expected in the next two decades to witness a further 50% increase, reaching around 500 million inhabitants. More importantly, the highest rate of population growth is for the 15-39 age group. The highest rate of population growth is for the 15-39 age group. In most industrialized countries, the rate of growth in this category is leveling off and declining. We will witness a huge generational change in the Middle East, which, accompanied by the unlimited accessibility to information and communication technology, will completely alter the economic map of the region. The Middle East deserves economic prosperity. It has suffered for too long. Let us not delay the peace process any further so as not to continue frustrating the aspiration of our young people. Out of our hope and optimism that progress will materialize in the peace process, Egypt has expressed its readiness to host the next Middle East and North Africa Economic Conference this fall. I trust that many of you will be active participants in the event. So work with us in order to create the necessary conditions for its convening. Egypt and U.S. are committed to continue working together towards this goal within the framework of a comprehensive peace. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to address for a moment the strong bonds of friendship that tie Egypt to America. As a result of more than two decades of close cooperation in the political, military, and economic spheres, we have established what is truly a vital strategic partnership between our two nations. Economically, the U.S. is Egypt's largest trading partner with over $4 billion in trade. Trade with California alone is almost $1 billion. Although American investment in Egypt is gradually increasing, having reached around $2.3 billion, we feel that there is much more room for improvement in view of the great current opportunities in our market. Already, many European companies are aggressively tapping the new dynamic investment climate in Egypt. American giant conglomerates are well-placed to partner with us, especially when it comes to our ambitious mega-projects of huge infrastructural dimensions. Bechtel, a name I'm sure you are very familiar with, has pioneered the way by constructing the first private sector power plant in the Middle East, a project worth more than $500 million, ushering in a new page in private sector power generation in Egypt. There are many other American success stories capitalizing on Egypt's strategy of economic integration into the world economy. Integration that starts with the European community in the north, all the way to Namibia, in the southern part of Africa, passing through the Arab world, a market of over a billion inhabitants. The most recent beneficiary of our integration efforts is Chrysler, which is planning to use its large venture in Egypt as an export base to all of Africa and the Middle East. Dear friends, our discussions with our American counterparts strongly reflect that both our countries are focused on the future. Within this context of change, the most important dimension being the trend towards globalization, Egypt and the U.S. can forge a new and promising partnership benefiting from their respective international and regional leadership roles. I expect the Middle East to undergo considerable change in the future. America will change too. The Egyptian-American partnership will also change and mature. But what will not change is our shared core beliefs in peace and justice and our solid shared interests in regional stability, security, and prosperity. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Amr Moussa, Foreign Minister of Egypt, for that vision of regional security and U.S.-Egyptian cooperation. Now Mac Letch, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, will conduct the questions and answers.
Thank you, Gloria Duffy, Commonwealth Club CEO. Foreign Minister Moussa, we have a large number of questions submitted by our audience, so let us begin. And if you would come up to the podium here, and I will read the questions. And what effect does the failure of the U.S. government to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty have on peacemaking and disarmament efforts elsewhere in the world and in the Middle East?
Well, we hope that the leadership role of the United States in the field of disarmament be reinforced by the adherence by the U.S. of that treaty. In fact, in the field of disarmament, especially when it comes to weapons of mass destruction and nuclear weapons, the leadership of the U.S. is very important to take steps, bold steps, move ahead, and accept no exceptions or deviations from that road. But if the U.S. abdicates or hesitates or vacillates, this will pose a grave danger to the disarmament drive or to drive towards full and complete disarmament. Okay.
Israel and Palestine have begun to negotiate the final peace treaty. As a representative of the country in your region with the first major treaty with Israel, what advice would you give to your Palestinian neighbors?
Well, if you ask me about an advice, it should be given to both parties, not only one. That you should both be fair and know that you are going to live together for generations to come, live next to each other. So it is time now to build the edifice of peace, good neighborliness, in fact, friendly and positive relations. It is not a matter of a few kilometers here or there, or claims, or using the favorable conditions, current conditions, in order to pin down the other party. The time has come for both of you to know that you are building together an edifice of peace and brighter future. And it is your responsibility. If one of you, let alone both of you, fail in this duty, therefore we won't reach our goal of peace, enduring peace, lasting peace for many generations to come.
Do you think that President Clinton's visit to Syria will promote this process to any extent?
Well, of course, President Clinton visited Syria already, and in his meeting with President Assad this week, next Sunday, I believe that it is a very important meeting, very important encounter, because it would relaunch the talks between Syria and Israel, and also, I'm sure, will put them on the right track in order to reach the conclusion as soon as possible. I know of President Clinton's determination to help achieve that peace, not only between Syria and Israel, but comprehensively in the Middle East while he is in office. And I would say very frankly that it is possible. It is not impossible if the political will, seriousness are there on both sides.
We have a number of questions about relations between Egypt and Israel. A number of people have asked if there is increasing amount of travel between the two countries, tourist travel, business interaction, and since Israel has a strong information technology industry, are there joint ventures developing in that area between Israel and Egypt?
Well, the relations between Egypt and Israel are somewhat of a special nature. Yes, there is peace between the two countries. There are normal relations between the two countries, but the continuation of the conflict, especially that on the Palestinian track or against the Palestinians, that are really of great importance to the Egyptian people and to the Arab people. The more that conflict continues, the less interaction we shall see between Israel and the rest of the Arabs. So now that there are negotiations and serious implementation of the agreements that have been signed, the relations with not only with Egypt but with the rest of the Arab countries, and especially when we see that there is progress also on the Syrian track and movement on the Lebanese track, that the normal relations will be more fruitful. The trade between Egypt and Israel is going on. They are among our first five partners in trade in the Middle East. The tourism is active, especially in the shores of the Red Sea and Sinai. And we can do much better under conditions of peace. And I believe that since we think that peace is now possible, brighter future for relations, we shall see a brighter future for the bilateral relations, interaction between people, trade between nations, and a warm kind of relations as we move towards peace.
What do you believe will be the result of Israel's pulling out of Lebanon, and does Egypt support that move?
We support all moves under the word withdrawal. We cannot advise Israel not to withdraw. In fact, they have to withdraw, not only from southern Lebanon, but from all the occupied territories since 1967. Therefore, but there is one point I should, in fact, underline here, that dealing with Lebanon, especially on the question of withdrawal, will have to emanate from the fact that Lebanon is a track like the other tracks, Syrian and Palestinians. It should not be treated as a card in maneuvers with Syria. Lebanon is a country, an independent country. It has a part of its territory occupied by Israel. If Israel withdraws from Lebanon, therefore the direct problem between Israel and Lebanon will cease to exist. And this will add definitely to the creation of a better atmosphere in the region or around the peace process. Having said that, I believe that with the talks resumed between Syria and Israel, with the active role of President Clinton and the administration at this stage, and with the commitment to withdraw from Lebanon, all that would perhaps formulate a fine package to be implemented within the next few months.
We have a surprising number of questions about the Pope's visit to Israel. do you see any effect on Middle Eastern peace as a result of that visit?
Well, the Pope visited Egypt last month. And currently he is visiting Jordan, Israel, and Palestine. The effects of the Pope's visit is always blessed effects and praying and giving hope and hopes to all concerned, especially that he will be on both sides of the equation today, Israel and Palestine, that it is in peace that they will succeed and they will prosper. But the Pope has no political agenda during his visit to the Middle East, and he will not, according to what we know, he is not going to discuss any political issue.
Is there continuing political turmoil in Egypt, and is the government more or less in charge of the conditions, and are Islamic terrorists presenting any problems at this point?
Well, the government, as you said, is very much in charge, and there is a unprecedented stability. Even the organizations that call for Islamic theories or Islamic policies, they know that the society and the Egypt is not ready for such a calls that to politicize the religion or to mix religion with politics. So as you know, as you see, as you hear, the situation in Egypt is firmly under the control of the society, of the government, and the troubles of past few years that occurred from 4 to 5 years ago are no longer with us.
Is there much cooperation amongst Middle Eastern countries to eliminate terrorism?
Well, there is much cooperation between all countries in the world to eliminate terrorism.
You can see why he is the foreign minister. The U.S. has begun reaching out to Iran in an effort to improve relations. What is Egypt's relationship with Iran, and is there any role for Egypt in facilitating talks between the U.S. and Iran?
Well, I don't think the U.S. needs any facilitator in their relations with Iran. Our relations are also improving with Iran. Iran is an important country in the Middle East. We started to be on speaking terms with them in the last 2 to 3 years. We talk to them. They talk with us. We consult on certain matters. The relations between Iran and Egypt are really candidate for more improvement in the very near future.
What are the biggest drawbacks to Egypt's moving ahead to strengthen its economy?
Well, let me not think of drawbacks, but think of the atmosphere in the region. Egypt embarked on the economic reform in the late 80s, early 90s. And we have succeeded. The indications, the indicators tell us tell of a success story so far. But the market should not be only the internal market, so we are trying to create a wider market around us. And as I mentioned in my brief speech, that we entered into a free trade area extending from the shores of the Mediterranean to the shores of the Indian Ocean, in fact, Atlantic Ocean, with 400 million inhabitants. We are joining Europe in a partnership agreement very soon that would usher in a new free trade zone around the Mediterranean. We are working also within the Arab nations to establish a common market to be finalized by the year 2007. And under conditions of peace, the regional economic cooperation will be very much activated. This creates a major area with almost 1 billion people, 1 billion consumers, that would open vistas of opportunity for all of us. If this doesn't happen, then this will be an impediment to the progress that Egypt hopes for. As for difficulties, there are the normal ups and downs in the economy, with the stock market going up one day and going down perhaps for some other. I have here the vice chairman of the Cairo Stock Exchange, a very charming young lady. If you are interested, you can always buy. She will help you buying some of the stock shares of other. So this is my answer, Mr. Chairman.
Do you see an increase in economic cooperation between Middle Eastern nations in line with developments in the various peace processes?
Yes, I do. Yeah. You do? The answer is yes, of course.
Could you give it a couple of examples?
You know what? Again, if you need example of cooperation, you know, I want you to know that with the peace process coming to its conclusion, natural conclusion, then the term Arab-Israeli relations will change from relations between adversaries into normal relations. Israel will be just another member of the Middle Eastern society, as all countries X or Y or Z. Here, the cooperation, the interaction, the trade, the investment, joint ventures, tourism, cultural exchanges, political understanding, consultation would be the order of the day. So under conditions of peace, everything is possible, and not only possible, but everything will happen, because it will be relations of peace. There is no reservation to cooperate with, consult with, visit, or welcome somebody coming from this country, because it will not be Israel in the meaning of the Arab-Israeli conflict that stayed with us for the last 50 years. It will be the neighbor called Israel, as any other country in the Middle East. And this is positive, as you know.
Would Egypt favor ending the sanctions against Iraq? Do you believe they have had a positive result in controlling Iraqis' activities?
Now, this is an important question to be added to those very serious questions you have addressed to me. The sanctions against Iraq have caused a lot of suffering to the Iraqi people. So the victim of the sanctions are the Iraqis. Many of you must have read or heard of the UNICEF report about the children in Iraq and how those sanctions have affected their health and their future, in fact. That's number one. Number two, no sanctions are there in perpetuity or should be there in perpetuity. The sanctions constitute a system to punish a certain government for a certain period of time until the international community is satisfied to a satisfactory degree that things have changed. After 10 years, almost 10 years, of inspection, of monitoring, of sanctions, I believe the time has come at least for the suspension of sanctions against Iraq. And this is the title of the resolution that has been adopted by the Security Council recently, with the approval of the government of the United States, the suspension of sanctions against Iraq. Of course, there are certain preconditions attached. Here, we have some difference of views, not only from the Arab nations, but even in the Security Council, because that resolution was not adopted by unanimity, but was adopted with the abstention of three permanent members of the Security Council.
How does the instability and warfare in sub-Saharan Africa influence Egypt, and do you have any suggestions for improvements of relations in that area?
Yes, we have. We are on constant contact with the U.S. To consult on this issue of the situation in sub-Saharan Africa. There is a lot to be done, and I know that the U.S. administration has become very much aware of the dangerous situation prevailing in that area of Africa, not only from economic point of view or social point of view, but also from the health point of view. AIDS is spreading out in that part, and they say, many reports state that over 30% of the population in that region is affected by that epidemic. So we have indeed a lot to do in this region. We have next week, the week after, in fact, the first week of April, a summit meeting, unprecedented summit meeting, that groups the 15 members, European members of the European Union and all countries of Africa in order to consider the situation, the economic, social, and also this health situation in Africa. At the same time, the U.S. Has embarked on many initiatives ever since the tour of President Clinton last year in Africa to deal with such a situation that indeed needs a lot of our attention, immediate attention, because of the serious situation there, prevailing there for those reasons I mentioned.
As you meet with leaders in Silicon Valley, how will you describe your specific strategy for developing an Egyptian Silicon Valley, and what unique resources does Egypt have to offer the international high-tech economy?
Well, in this, we're going to visit the Silicon Valley, and as I mentioned, our goal is to build a small Silicon Valley in Egypt. This could be done, of course, with the private sector in Egypt, joint ventures with America, a role played by the government to build the infrastructure in this region. We are going to learn a lot from your Silicon Valley. We have many Egyptians working there with the companies, learning, and more are to come. This is a door for us for the future, the Silicon Valley in Egypt, to be associated with your Silicon Valley here.
We have a lot of discussion in this country about the haves and the have-nots in the information technology revolution. And, of course, you have a large number of have-nots in Egypt. Have you had any success in bringing information technology to your classrooms, and what plans are there to try to decrease the have-nots in terms of information technology?
Well, thank you very much. This is an important question. I know that there is no free lunch, but now you have reached the end of my of what I can say. I have a colleague of mine, member of the delegation, who can really give you an answer, a better answer than mine, to this question. Will you come, Mr. Dr. Makur?
Thank you, Your Excellency. Indeed, as far as schools are concerned, a project has been ongoing for now at least 5 years. We have covered some 17 or 18,000 schools. However, let me be very frank on that score. We do have labs in these schools. We may have one lab, 5 or 6 computers in those schools, but again, they are yet to be fully utilized. The new plan that was launched last December of 1999, which is a national plan for information technology, calls for the increase of those applications of computers in schools to 200,000 schools in Egypt, in a much better concerted approach, mainly relying on training, sensitization, and getting a much better faculty of people capable of running those laboratories and capable of teaching those younger kids how to use and how to be part of what's going on in that wonderful world of the internet and the information technology. Thank you.
That was Mr. Mohammed Matkour, an expert on informatics, member of my delegation here, and also a prominent private sector operative, as they say.
You had mentioned that you expect the Middle East to change dramatically. In what specific ways do you expect change?
Well, I expect change in all fields, especially the technology and the informatics. That's what I meant by that change.
Could you elaborate in terms of any political and general economic change?
Well, as I said, the whole Middle East will change with the peace process succeeding and peace settlements signed. That would introduce a new atmosphere and a new policy, a new interaction. That would introduce change, not only in Egypt or in the Arab world or in Israel, but it will introduce a major change in a vast area around us, affecting the Mediterranean, Africa, and West Asia in general. Those changes will affect all walks of life, especially the economic field.
Could you explain the role of Egypt in the New Agenda Coalition and at the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference in April?
Well, that is an important question, but I am not going to reveal our line in that conference. However, you should know that we insist that as all countries insist, that the NPT should be universal, and the element of universality has to be underlined. We continue to call on Israel to join the NPT. We continue to call on India and Pakistan to do the same. We have a resolution adopted in 1995 together with the renewal of the treaty for an indefinite period. This resolution on the Middle East will have to be honored, will have to be implemented, will have to be operated. And therefore, the goal, our goal, is the goal of the majority of countries that require, that want this NPT to go universal. Under the present circumstances, the NPT is not in a good shape. The NPT is being threatened. Its credibility is being reduced. So we'll have to restore credibility to the NPT from that standpoint, that universality should be the goal that all of us commit ourselves to attain. First and foremost, the U.S. should do that.
What will the President of Egypt seek to address in his meetings with President Clinton?
Well, the President, President Mubarak, has quite a tall agenda with him, and between us and the U.S., there are a lot of issues to be discussed at that highest level. From political nature into economic nature, bilateral. The peace process will be high on that agenda. To discuss the options, the possibilities, and in fact to work together to reaffirm the desire of both countries to work together in order for us to achieve this goal, and soon, while President Clinton is in office. We are going to talk also about problems of regional nature in the Middle East and the Mediterranean, Iraq, Sudan, North Africa, Africa. Then the bilateral relations between the two countries, as you have seen, there's very active bilateral relations on the economic field and the political and military and, in fact, all sides of relations. The annual meeting between President Clinton and President Mubarak have proven to be very useful in pushing forward and strengthening not only the relations, but the understanding, the consultation system, and the strategic relationship between U.S. and Egypt.
The U.S. has had a checkered career in negotiating successfully with Middle Eastern countries. What would you advise our negotiators on any specific ways that they could improve their negotiating with Arab countries?
The U.S. has a very talented, not only a very, very talented teams negotiating on all sides of the political and economic spectrum. We talk with the Americans, as they do with many other countries, on several issues. For example, the trade, the effects or the outcome of the Seattle Conference, the World Trade Organization, the future of trade system, international trade system. Also, the NPT and issues pertaining to disarmament. All that is subject to negotiations or to talks and consultations. The Americans are, in fact, are not doing any negotiations in the peace process, within the framework of the peace process. They are helping the parties, mediating, proposing, offering ideas, but they are not doing the negotiations. So the term, the question itself is not that accurate, that the U.S. is negotiating all the way with all countries about all issues. It is not exactly that.
President Clinton is currently in India, and as former ambassador to India, what would you advise him, if you were talking very quietly, on advice to India relative to some of the issues that he's concerned about there?
Well, this is a complicated part of the world. India is one of the largest countries in the world. The second largest, and moving to be the first, the largest, in fact, within 2 decades or so. They have achieved a lot of progress, including the nuclear capability. Here is one point I believe President Clinton is going to talk about. Also, the relations with Pakistan and the situation in that region of SARC. The progress India has made in the many fields, especially science and technology, is impressive indeed. So the trade relations also, the between U.S. and India, the Indian-Chinese relations, the role of India in Asia, all that, I believe, is on the agenda of the talks between President Clinton and the Indian leaders. So this is a... by way of analysis, but for an advice, I need to be paid for that, so I'm not going to.
Okay. To return to a minute to information technology, as the Middle East becomes wired, what impact do you see the Internet having on people's attitudes, behavior, thoughts, et cetera, considering the fact that one of the major, some of the major uses of the Internet, of the Internet, are pornography and illegal betting on sports?
Well, the effects on the Egyptian public or the Egyptian users of the Internet is the same as on others. This is globalization with the positive and the negative side of it. So you can answer the same question, what is the effect of such programs on the Internet and on the public here, in the, or the generations or the youth in this country? There is no difference than that. So I believe that that's it. This will be, okay, thank you very much. Okay.
What can Egypt do through its embassies to promote the Arab cause and the Arab image in the United States?
Well, it's not a question of image, Mr. Chairman, or not only a question of image. We live in a new world, of globalization, of shared interests, of changes in all societies, be them within the Arab world, or Asian world, or African world, or European world. This is the age of change. The Arab world is part and parcel of the international community and lives in a large, huge part of the North Africa and West Asia, has a lot of rich resources, have a lot of young people, talented young people, moving to establish peace with the, or to close the file of animosity and conflict with Israel after 50 years. So we have vistas of opportunity ahead of us. And America would share in that, not only in building that, but in benefiting from it. And we continue to ask U.S. to move with us, to build a future that would meet the requirements, the demands, the rights of the generations, our young generations, that I have referred to in my speech. The America should know, and the Americans should know, that Arabs are the friends of America. They are not enemies. The Egyptians, in particular, are very much friends of America and the American society. What we need is to go together, work together, and to reach a world that is free from threats of weapons, of arms race. And the important thing is not what only what the Arab side does, but also what America does. We need a balanced approach in all the future endeavors, in particular to build a safer Middle East free from weapons of mass destruction, including the nuclear weapons. By this, I thank you. I thank the guests for a very interesting lunch and after lunch and many intelligent questions. I'm sure that attending those meetings is very beneficial indeed for everybody. I wished I were a citizen of San Francisco in order to join your club. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to His Excellency Amr Moussa, Minister of Foreign Affairs for Egypt, for joining us today. We also thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club, as well as those listening on radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest continuing public affairs forum, is adjourned.